Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a bizarre attempted armed coup by the founder of the Tea Party organization Freedom Works, Dick Armey, in which he took back control only to later accept an $8 million payoff from a wealthy donor to go away. Kenneth Vogel, the chief investigative reporter for Politico, joins us to discuss disarray inside the conservative movement since Obama's re-election and Obama's return to the White House from vacation in Hawaii to await a last-minute deal on the so-called fiscal cliff with only 5 days left before the U.S. hits the debt ceiling limit. Then we will speak with a member of the Syrian opposition and of the Day After group of prominent Syrians planning to take over when Assad falls. Muhaf Juizati, a professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University, joins us to discuss the latest high-level defection from the regime and reports that Iran is planning a guerrilla war inside Syria to destabilize any future government. Then finally, we'll discuss whether Obama will cave on the nomination of Senator Hagel for Secretary of Defense and also look into the once and future Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, who unveiled his new cabinet today and vowed to enact bold economic policies to reverse stagnation and deflation. Steve Clemens, the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and co-founder with Chalmers Johnson of the Japan Policy Research Institute, joins us to discuss the fate of the Hagel nomination and the comeback of the former Japanese prime minister, the seventh premier in 6 years, who served for a year in 2006, only to be ousted ignominiously on the grounds of ill health. Joining us now is Kenneth Vogel, the chief investigative reporter for Politico, who tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence. He has covered politics and government at all levels, from small-town cop shops and school boards to state houses, Congress, and the presidential campaign trail, traveling during the 2008 race with the campaigns of Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, and Joe Biden. More recently, he has covered the growth of the Tea Party and the Tea Party movement and the super PACs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Vogel.
Hey, great to be with you, Ian.
And Ken, we'll get to this bizarre story of Dick Armey, which you've covered. I know it happened back in September, but let's just talk about for a moment with what's happening today. The president gets back from Hawaii to the White House tonight. I imagine he might well be there by now. And tomorrow, the Senate convenes. The House hasn't said what they're doing. They've been in conference calls, apparently. What's the president going to do? Is he twiddling his thumbs and trying to shame them into action?
Well, the White House did float a much smaller sort of fallback option last week, and they continue to be in talks with that with Republicans about that, but have found very little support among Republicans in the Senate. Much less in the House, which is going to be much tougher and less fertile ground for them. So it's unclear. What we did see from the administration was the Treasury Department and Tim Geithner announcing in a letter to congressional leaders today that the government would hit the debt limit on December 31st on the New Year's Eve day and then have to take, quote, extraordinary measures, end quote, to avoid exhausting the government's borrowing limit in the new year. It's unclear what that means. It seems clear that that was intended to light a fire under congressional leaders. It doesn't seem to have been effective.
Well, but the debt ceiling limit was the reason why this whole sequester, which has led to the fiscal cliff, happened. It was the fact that the Tea Party rebelled over the debt ceiling limit, which had never happened before. So one would assume that they're going to be even more upset about the debt ceiling happening on Monday as opposed to sometime in mid-February, which I believe was the original estimation. It's happening over a month earlier, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And then the announcement of it in such dramatic fashion, as the talks appear to be at a complete impasse, does seem to be a bit of political theater. Then again, having just witnessed, as you referenced earlier, the debt ceiling debate, in 2011, there was that also struck a lot of folks as a bit of political theater. And you know, this arrangement that they reached that would sort of prompt this automatic sequester spending cuts across the board was really entitled, was really intended to, increase the sense of urgency among Republicans in particular, that if they were not able to reach a larger deal, that there would be cuts closer to home, close to where they least want to see cuts in defense spending. Now it appears as if we are getting closer and closer to that point. And it's really, I think, if you talk to veteran Washington watchers who predict all kinds of possible ways that this could play out, I don't personally see any sort of resolution here. And I think the folks who suggest that they know what's going to happen are engaging in a bit of speculative punditry that there might not be a whole lot of basis for.
But again, Ken Vogel, the chief investigative reporter for Politico, who tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence, this is circumstance piling on circumstance. You can make the argument that this fiscal cliff is something of a fiction and the world is not going to end if we go over it. In fact, if we go over it, it might be one of the few ways that some real revenues will get raised. The debt ceiling, if you go to the mat on the debt ceiling as the Tea Party did last time, you can do some serious economic damage. Remember, as a result of the first time they did it, or the last time they did it, the U.S. got downgraded.
Yeah, well, we've seen a bit of reaction in the stock market already, where at each point at which there appeared to be the possibility of some progress in these talks over the fiscal cliff, and ultimately to yield nothing, the stock market took a dive. And I think, if we don't have a resolution here in the days before this December 31st deadline that Secretary Geithner has now thrown out there, you're probably going to see more of that. And you're right, Republicans were blamed for that, and the Tea Party was blamed for that downgrade and was blamed for the sort of situation that we're in now. Again, at that point, it appeared that Republicans sort of had the upper hand to some extent as a result of the mandate that many deduced out of the 2010 midterm elections, where Republicans, and with the aid of Tea Party groups, including FreedomWorks, which we'll talk about here shortly, but also Tea Party activists, really did send a message about spending, about government spending, and it was one that the newly elected members of the Tea Party Congress took quite literally to their detriment and to the detriment of the party, which we saw play out in the 2012 elections, where now Democrats appear to have the mandate. That's what the elections were about. They were about this idea that higher taxes on the wealthy were necessary in order to get our nation's fiscal house in order. That's the message that most Democrats took out of President Obama's reelection and their gains in the Senate and the House. And the Republicans in the House in particular do not seem to have taken that same message out of it.
Again, I'm speaking with Kenneth Vogel, who's a chief investigative reporter for Politico, who tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence. And more recently, he has covered the growth of the Tea Party movement and the super PACs. And let's turn to the story which Politico had some time back. The Washington Post is carrying a story about it today, about Dick Armey's attempted armed coup of the Tea Party. Was it back in, back in September that Dick Armey, the chairman and former House Majority Leader, went into the headquarters of FreedomWorks, where he had been in charge, along with his wife Susan and an aide carrying a holstered handgun at the waist, who turns out to be a former Capitol policeman. Apparently, the aide escorted FreedomWorks' top two employees off the premises. The armed fellow, while Armey suspended several other people, who then subsequently broke down in tears, and I believe he reinstated them. And then 6 days later, on September the 10th, Dick Armey agreed to a severance package of an $8 million and the five ousted employees coming back. Apparently, all this was done by Richard J. Stevenson, a reclusive Illinois millionaire who is basically one of the big funders of FreedomWorks. So that's the broad strokes. Walk us through this in the context of general disarray in the conservative movement since the re-election of Barack Obama.
Yeah, there was certainly quite a bit of dissent brewing within the conservative movement generally within some of these Tea Party groups, more specifically in the run-up to the election, which is when this sort of showdown occurred, when the tensions boiled over here at Freedom Marks. Broadly, within the conservative movement, you know, that this, I think both sides are sort of struggling to adjust to this new era, new style of politics that was ushered in by the Supreme Court Citizens United decision in 2010 and subsequent federal court decisions that allow for this explosion of big money into politics and really empowered some of these big donors and the operatives and groups that sort of had their ear to seize power in some ways from the parties, the political parties and the campaigns themselves, which are, of course, limited in how much money they can take, unlike groups like Freedom Works, nonprofit groups and super PACs. And so you saw tensions both over generally over how this money should be spent, as well as the balance between the parties and the candidates and these outside groups and the big donors. But you saw a lot of debate about whether establishment candidates who were deemed to be sort of more viable in general election matchups with Democrats in particular, so the, on the Republican side where there was kind of a dispute, which is the very dispute that sort of undergirded the Tea Party movement, as to whether it was better to have these principled candidates who maybe appealed to the base but weren't deemed to be electable, weren't deemed to be sort of viable as mainstream candidates in the general election. And then even more specifically, you saw disputes over tactics. We saw this a lot with the Karl Rove Group's Crossroads, where a lot of money was going into television advertisements, and there were grassroots activists, Tea Partiers, and, in fact, establishment GOP operatives who said, hey, you know what, this money would be better spent on ground organizing. In the case of the Freedom Works feud, it seems to be a little bit of both, where there was a dispute over the tactics. There was some thought, not just from Dick Armey, but from loyalists, that Freedom Works was spending too much money on television ads and also on sort of communication stuff. So, you know, accumulating a big Facebook presence and spending a lot of money on Facebook advertising and social media advertising and on a book that was written using Freedom Works resources by the number two, the former number two, now the number one person there with whom Dick Armey had this falling out, Matt Kibbe. And Armey became disenchanted with this, took his dispute to the board of directors of Freedom Works during a meeting in Colorado, in a Tony, Colorado ski town. And the board, you know, this is presented as an armed feud, but the board actually did, in fact, give him clearance and said, you know, we are siding with you. And the board suspended without pay, placing on administrative leave Matt Kibbe, number two, the number three guy there, Adam Brandon. That's sort of where this Washington Post story picks up. Adam Brandon and Matt Kibbe seemed unwilling to accept that. So Dick Armey had this confrontation with them that sounds quite dramatic.
And but it only lasted 6 days, and it looks as if the reversal happened with the promise of this $8 million payoff to Dick Armey by Richard Stevenson, the reclusive Illinois millionaire who's the founder of the for-profit Cancer Treatment Centers of America.
Yeah, that's right. Dick Stevenson, my understanding is he's been sort of a Matt Kibbe loyalist. He goes way back with Dick Armey, but he kind of bonded with Matt Kibbe, both over Matt Kibbe's own bout with testicular cancer, which dates back several years and which he's been clear of now for, I think, at least half a dozen years, and over their sort of shared love of Ayn Rand and really classic libertarian economic philosophy, which Dick Armey, despite being an economist by training, he likes to point that out, and also having been an architect of the Gingrich Revolution, the Republican Revolution of 1994, was seen by many Tea Party activists and by many libertarians as a kind of a bad fit for the Tea Party movement and for Freedom Works. He became known in his post-congressional career as a lobbyist, sort of big money conservative. Terms that we hear thrown about pejoratively by Tea Partiers is rent seeking. This being the sort of corporatist influence over American politics, where big corporations or interest groups are able to pay lobbyists to go and get special treatment from Congress for their principles, for their legislative priorities. And Dick Armey was seen as epitomizing that in some ways by Tea Party activists. So it was odd. I think a lot of folks who watched Dick Armey and FreedomWorks really latch on to the Tea Party movement in 2009. I mean, FreedomWorks is an organization that long predated the Tea Party, but when the Tea Party came along and they positioned themselves out front of the Tea Party movement and were very effective in mobilizing activists and getting them to turn out to rallies and enter their names into FreedomWorks' database and give money to FreedomWorks, FreedomWorks became kind of a leading Tea Party entity, and it was odd to see that, and it was odd to see Dick Armey out front of it. And I think in many ways he was just always kind of a bad fit for it, but he was a guy who knew a lot of very, very wealthy conservatives who could get them to contribute large sums of money, which became even more important after Citizens United, when that money could be spent directly on politics and didn't have to go into issue education and issue advocacy. And so, you know, it will be interesting now to watch what happens with FreedomWorks without Dick Armey at the helm. Even if he was only serving in a figurative way capacity, he was still able to really help out with fundraising. Now there's this one big, big donor, Dick Stevenson, who you mentioned, who apparently has committed to continuing to fund it. But one big donor, even at $12 million a year, does not a political juggernaut make. FreedomWorks has a budget that's upwards of $40 million a year. So unless they're able to appeal to a wider swath of donors, both big donors, not necessarily on the order of Stevenson, but very wealthy folks, and also grassroots folks, you know, they already are sort of seen as losing cachet within the conservative movement, both with the loss of Armey and with the diminishing to some extent of the energy of the Tea Party movement. You know, there's quite a lot of upheaval and transition, and this feud with FreedomWorks is perhaps a more dramatic incarnation of it. But I think stuff like this is happening below the surface across the conservative movement.
Well, just in closing, Kenneth Vogel, it does seem that the Tea Party that started out expressing outrage over what happened on Wall Street in 2008, and many have argued that it's become, instead of a grassroots radical organization that's appalled by government spending, it's turned into a kind of an astroturf organization. And just last week, the Tea Party caucus humiliated the Speaker, Boehner, on his Plan B vote, and they basically went to the mat saying, we're not going to raise taxes on the millionaires and billionaires. But in terms, just in terms of this coup we're talking about, or failed coup, or reversed coup, whatever it is, it seems that on both sides of the argument, on Stevenson's side, he was throwing money at Joe Walsh, the Tea Party guy who lost in the House race against the wounded or the double amputee from the Iraq War, Tammy Duckworth. And on the other side, Dick Armey threw good money after bad with the guy, the Senate candidate in Indiana, Murdoch, and with Todd Akin, after both of those guys had made fools of themselves. So it seems like there's a lot of blame to go around here.
Yeah, that's right. And that is the type of blame that we're seeing more broadly across the conservative movement. I mean, FreedomWorks won some races. Karl Rove's Crossroads groups won far fewer, particularly considering how much more they spent and in how many more races they spent it. Some of that, I think, donors are chalking up to it just being a bad year. Others, donors, though, are seriously asking whether these groups are good investments or whether they're just squandering their money. And there is a strong backlash, even if it's behind the scenes at this point, where donors are asking that, and they're asking that directly, whether they have been taken for a ride, for instance, just quickly with Karl Rove, or Karl Rove in the last literally the last week of the election, was telling some big donors, hey, if we just get another million or $5 million from you, we think that we're going to be able to put Pennsylvania in play and help Mitt Romney win Pennsylvania, because our internal polls show that that's within the margin of error. Well, Mitt Romney, Barack Obama just crushed him in Pennsylvania. Some of these donors, that really stuck out to them. And they ended up asking, hey, did you know that your poll that we were that far away in Pennsylvania and you just wanted more money from us? Or were you that bad at reading the data that you legitimately thought that Pennsylvania was in play? Either way, we're not sure if you're a trustworthy investment going forward.
Well, Ken Vogel, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Kenneth Vogel, who is the chief investigative reporter for Politico. He tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence, and has covered politics and government at all levels, from small-town cop shops and school boards to state houses, Congress, and the presidential campaign trail, traveling during the 2008 campaign with the campaigns of Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, and Joe Biden. And more recently, he's covered the growth of the Tea Party movement and the super PACs. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with somebody from the Day After group of prominent Syrians planning to take over when Assad falls.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so blue.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Muraf Jujati, who's a Syrian-born specialist on Middle East affairs, particularly Syrian politics. He's currently Professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies, and has also served as a National Program Officer in Syria for the United Nations Development Program, and as an advisor to the Syrian delegation to Middle East peace talks. Welcome to Background Briefing, Muraf Jujati.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you've been in the neighborhood. Obviously, Syria is a difficult country to be in, and you're a part of a new group formed the day after. And of course, there's been a lot of criticism of the Free Syrian Army and of the coordinating committees, and in the West, suggesting that there really isn't a government out there. There's just different groups of armed rebels. But it sounds like the work that you've been doing, along with other prominent Syrians, would indicate that, in fact, there are plans for the day after.
Well, yes, you're right. The criticism was that the opposition did not have a vision for the future, let alone a government. Well, actually, some 45 of us Syrians, whether expatriate or from the inside, have been gathering for the past 6 months in order to discuss and debate and to put together a vision of the future. And that is called the Day After, which in fact is really a list of recommendations and suggestions for any new transitional government that will take over power after the collapse of the Assad regime, in order to minimize what most people think would be a very chaotic situation inside Syria until the new order consolidates its power. It is a vision that calls for a civil and democratic Syria in which all Syrians, regardless of their ethnic backgrounds or their sectarian affiliations, would be equal before the law.
So you mentioned, Amarov Djerriyoti, that when Assad falls, and of course Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, has been saying that for some time, he hasn't fallen and he seems to be resorting to desperate measures. There's still a possibility he'll resort to the use of chemical weapons. There are indications that he is running out of arms in spite of Russian and Iranian help. They're using some very crude and primitive bombs that they're dropping from aircraft. He has started to use his Scud missiles. And then on the Syrian opposition side, there's persistent talk about the problems with the jihadi elements within the broad umbrella. So what gives you confidence that this will be over soon, and confidence that the more hardline rebels won't be the ones that will exact a price on whatever new government might form?
Well, if I compare the military positions that are had by the regime today and by the Free Syrian Army, if I compare this to a year ago, it truly is a far cry. A year ago, the Free Syria Army was a very small ragtag army consisting of soldiers only who had defected from the army because they refused orders to shoot civilians. Them, in combination with a few civilian volunteers who wanted to defend their homes and their families. Well, now this Free Syrian Army is a group of 100,000 that have taken over very large parts of Syrian territory, including almost the entire north of Syria, including something like 80% of Aleppo, which is the second largest city in Syria. They have taken over military bases. They now control air force bases, and they even have been able to extract from the regular army, through battles, tanks, anti-aircraft missiles, and a whole lot of ammunition. On the other hand, the state keeps on retreating. It keeps on shrinking in terms of size. And the numerous defections that are going on, the latest of which was yesterday, a major general, a commander of the military police, suggests truly that the regime of Assad is beginning to be seriously eroded. And so, yes, it has taken a long time. Yes, it has taken a great toll, but I think the fall is going to be inevitable.
And the Major General al-Shalal, who was the head of the military police, who just showed up in Turkey, said, "I declare my defection from the army because of its deviation from its fundamental mission to protect the nation and transformation into gangs of murder and destruction." Now, the suggestion is that there are a number of these high-level people that have actually been in touch with the Syrian opposition before they actually defect. So that would indicate that the Assad inner circle is crumbling. But what do you make, Muraf Djerriyoti, of the reports that Iran is going to send its al-Quds forces in? They already have sent some of them in. And Iran is determined not to lose Syria, which they appear to be losing, but they will make Syria ungovernable and ferment guerrilla war and destabilize any future government that might follow the fall of Assad.
Yeah, several things here. I think this is also a sign of not only Assad's desperation in using more and more lethal weapons, including, as you mentioned earlier, the barrel bombs, but also even poison gas that he has sprayed over Hamas 2 days ago. This is a desperation of the Iranian regime as well. Syria, of course, is a major pillar of Iranian strength. Syria gives Iran its reach into the Mediterranean basin, into the Arab-Israeli conflict, which makes Iran larger than its size, really. And so Syria is strategically extremely important for the Iranian regime. The Iranian regime has already, and for some time, been sending Al-Quds forces, IRGC forces, has been sending plenty of military equipment and ammunition, and has been pumping into the Syrian economy billions of dollars. So there is a very large stake for Iran in the survivability of the Assad regime. And now the Iranian regime has taken to threats that should the Assad regime collapse, and I think they know it will, the threat is that they will continue this war inside Syria even after the collapse of their ally, in order to deter the revolutionaries, the rebels in Syria, from carrying on their project.
So how much of that is bluster, and how much damage could the Iranians do in a post-Assad Syria?
Well, look, they have already done a very lot of damage. They not only have a physical presence on the ground in Syria, but they are also training the Syrian security services. They are not alone. They are with their ally Hezbollah, who has also equipment and men on the ground. They have inflicted a lot of damage, and I do take them for their word. I think they will, even after the collapse of the Assad regime, try to make it impossible for any post-Assad government to take over power.
Again, I'm speaking with Mohrab Juzjati, who's a Syrian-born specialist on Middle East affairs, particularly Syrian politics, and he's currently professor of Middle East studies at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. And he was recently in the region where he's a part of a group of prominent Syrians called the Day After, a group planning on a new government and a transition from the Assad regime, which is will inevitably fall. That seems to be the consensus. Even the Russians now are joining in the belief that Assad's days are numbered. Do you think the Russians are just going to get out of it, and they're not going to be spoilers like the Iranians are?
They're going to try to extract some price for this. They are not giving up easily on Assad, but they, I think, they now admit, at least to themselves, that Assad is going to fall. They will very much want to maintain some sort of an influence inside Syria. Syria also would be a major loss for them. But they certainly will extract a price, yeah.
So then give us a sense, Mohrab Juzjati, of the work that you've been doing in this group the Day After, just to go forward to the day that Assad falls. And it's not just Assad, the family, but the regime has to fall, I think, or, you know, there's still a possibility they'll retreat to the Mediterranean coast and the Alawite Mountains there and around the port of Tartus, apparently. There's some talk that they're digging in there. But assuming that they do fall altogether, what kind of a government do you think can step in and you know, bring about the healing that's necessary? Because, you know, there are a lot of groups within the country that support Assad, the Druze, the Christians, for example. So give us a sense of how the healing would begin.
Yeah, well, here I take issue with the word support. I don't think many people support Assad. It is the fear of the unknown that is directing and guiding them, rather than support for Assad. It is not all Christians by any means, as there are many, many Christians within the revolution. The same holds for Druze, and the same holds for many minorities. But I do agree with you. There are a whole bunch of folks that are scared of what is going to happen after. And so what we have done is to dissect the Day After in several issue areas, including economic reform, constitutional reform, electoral reform, the security sector reform, and the rule of law and transitional justice. I will give you an example of what we are talking about. We have taken several lessons from elsewhere in the neighborhood, such as Libya and Iraq and so on, and we have decided for a civilian authority over the military, a military that would be funded by a democratically elected parliament. Their mandate would be to defend Syria and to be totally apolitical. So here it is not that we are going to carry out a de-Ba'athification, as was the case in Iraq, which paralyzed the state. Here we will try to maintain the institutions that are in place. There will not be any de-Ba'athification that takes place. But in the armed forces, that group will be vetted for those who have blood on their hands, which would be, of course, which would face courts of law. In transitional justice, we have a very, very important work that we have done. We have taken examples from South Africa and so on, and we will have truth commissions. And so all in all, it is what we are looking for, a democratically elected state, which is inclusive of all Syrians, again, regardless of their ethnic or sectarian affiliations, and a group and a future government that is not only representative, but also democratic and a civil state.
Well, Murhaf Jujadi, I thank you very much for joining us here today, and we will certainly stay in touch. And obviously, you're going to be involved in a lot of work once this regime falls. And I thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Murhaf Jujadi, who's a Syrian-born specialist on Middle East affairs, particularly Syrian politics. He's currently a professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. He also serves as National Program Officer in Syria for the United Nations Development Program and is advisor to the Syrian delegation to the Middle East peace talks, and is now with the Day After group of prominent citizens planning the post-Assad regime. Let's take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about whether or not Obama will cave in on the nomination of Senator Hagel and also the seventh Japanese prime minister in 6 years. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Steve Clemens, who is Washington Editor-at-Large for The Atlantic and Editor-in-Chief of Atlantic Live. He is also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation. And previously, he served as Executive Director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Clemens.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And just before we talk about Japan's seventh prime minister in 6 years, the once and future PM Shinzo Abe, you were just on Chris Matthews' Hardball on MSNBC talking about what appears to be the possibility that President Obama will have two strikes against him in terms of those that he wanted to choose as his most important members of his cabinet. First, the Secretary of State, where he capitulated and went with John Kerry. And secondly, at the Department of Defense, where there are signs that he may be wavering on Chuck Hagel.
Yeah, well, I think that that's absolutely right. In the sense that what the White House seems to be doing is leaking out names, and then rather than letting the Senate confirmation process, you know, do what it's supposed to do, they just sort of hang people out on a vine and have them hit around a bit. And I think that it's for many people, it's turned into a pretty gross process, to such a point where four former national security advisors, Brent Scowcroft, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Frank Carlucci, and James Jones, all came out in the Washington Post later today and said this is essentially a disgusting process and stood by Hagel's integrity and spoke about it and just said it's unreasonable for people, you'll not people, you know, going into public services. This is how they're brought into discussion about their nomination, and the White House remains really quiet. And on top of that, the nominee themselves are not able to defend themselves, because if they do go out and try and defend themselves, that will, in the way the White House is getting these people through nominations, qualify them. So it's a process. We discussed it with Chris Matthews and, you know, discussed how kind of deplorable this process has been for both Susan Rice and now Chuck Hagel.
Well, clearly it's the neocons and the Israeli lobby, isn't it, that are just digging up dirt every day, even though I noticed somebody that knows Chuck Hagel from Nebraska, the local rabbi there, who spoke highly of him and castigated those that are trying to sling mud as being, unhelpful, to say the least.
That rabbi in Nebraska wrote a great piece. But so have others in Israel itself who've written about what a great and important strategic thinker Hagel has been. But there are some groups, like the Republican Jewish Council and others, that have tried to portray this concern or doubt among Jewish Americans as being monolithic. And it just simply isn't. And I think that the biggest comment out there, there have been really two, but the one that just appeared today in the New York Times was Tom Friedman's piece saying, give Chuck a chance, and essentially saying, Chuck Hagel is saying the things that Israel needs to hear, and he's a more genuine friend than Bill Kristol and others who seem to not want to, tell the most right-wing elements of the Israeli political establishment that they're taking Israel off its democratic rails. And I think an important thing to keep in mind. On top of it is my colleague Jeff Goldberg, who is never accused by anyone. Jeff Goldberg, of course, is a columnist at The Atlantic and also at Bloomberg. And Jeff is never accused of any of being in the realist camp in foreign policy. And he endorsed Hagel for the same reasons that Tom Friedman did. And so here are two iconic leaders, one much closer to Netanyahu and the Israeli establishment in Goldberg, and then Tom Friedman, who really is an oracle for many Jewish Americans in the country, are basically saying, Bill Kristol and the neoconservative community are wrong.
Again, I'm speaking with Steve Clemens, who is the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation, and previously he served as executive director of the Japan-American Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. So, Steve, what does this say about the president then? I mean, he got reelected with a substantial majority in the popular vote, the greatest majority. He did better than Reagan did. And he just wiped the other guy out in the Electoral College. But, he came out, I think, about 5 million ahead in the popular vote. So what is wrong with him? Why is he not asserting himself? And if he's asking for people to have the wind at his back, then he can't sell out, his own choices and get hammered like this for no good reason.
I have a generous interpretation, Ian, and an ungenerous one. Generous one is that he's someone who keeps his powder dry and lets things play out. And, many of us have all seen Spielberg's movie Lincoln. And one of the things that characterized Lincoln before he made that very fundamental decision to invest everything in getting the 13th Amendment passed was that he dithered and he weighed things and he was compromising here and there. And people often didn't know what he stood for, to tell you the truth. And I think to some degree you could argue that Barack Obama and his team don't want to spend a lot of political capital on controversial nominees, and because what they would need to invest to achieve it robs from other things that they would like to do. That's a generous interpretation. The less generous one is that, in great contrast to George W. Bush, who actually did win the presidency with a contested vote in the Supreme Court by just one vote, had lost the popular vote, George Bush came out and act like he in every battle he would declare victory before the battle had been fought and the Democrats would concede. And very frequently you see Barack Obama doing the opposite, of having the cards in his hand, of being able to, you know, declare that he's really got his opposition outnumbered and the wind is in his sails after having that great presidential victory. But he often concedes way too much to rivals in opposition. In this case on Hegel, you know, my view is he's allowing his enemies, people who did not want him to be president of the United States, to essentially dictate the terms of who are going to be in his cabinet. It's remarkable. So that is the, I think that is, you know, every presidency fundamentally comes down to the character of the president and the chief executive in that office. And fundamentally, I think Barack Obama is someone who does not get out and feel the confidence of a win right away. He basically retreats very rapidly and then begins to calculate everything again. And I unfortunately find that one of the flaws in his presidency and in him personally.
Well, I think, Steve Clements, you were being charitable there in talking about John McCain, his former rival in 2008, who he trounced and who has been absolutely embittered ever since and seems to have done everything he could to undermine Obama's presidency. And he and Lindsey Graham, of course, tag-teamed on bringing down Susan Rice. And
that's right.
They're doing the same thing, although more so Lindsey Graham in this case with Chuck Hagel. I don't understand, is there any other negotiations going on where he's doing a trade-off? I know they're trying to make a deal to stop the Senate filibuster, but the idea that you, and by the way, the real backup is in judicial nominees that Obama has not pushed hard for. So I know they're trying to make a deal with the Republicans in the Senate. Is this a part of the deal? In other words, is he throwing everything into the hopper?
No, I actually have to report to say that there's nothing that I have learned that shows me that the Hagel nomination per se is part of any other deal making with the GOP, because you've had both Democrats and Republicans raise them, but they're all basically thinking the same. So Chuck Schumer and Lindsey Graham and John McCain are basically all in the same place on Israel. So the fact that they happen to belong to different political parties is not important. I think that what is happening in terms of the president's negotiation on a number of other fronts, particularly fiscal cliff issues, where his primary focus is right now, is that may be where there'll be negotiating and deal-making going on. I think what's happened is, after the success of knocking out Susan Rice, you had a crowd that was very giddy with what they achieved. And I got to tell you, the president and his political advisors, because this is more with his political advisors than it is with his national security advisors, the Valerie Jarretts and Pfeiffer's and others that are, you know, very, very close to the president, I think are making a very bad judgment call, because they're sending the signal to their political opposition that they can continue to do this in case after case after case and fundamentally begin to dictate who will come in. So you've got Paul Wolfowitz and Bill Kristol out pushing someone who's a friend of mine, Michelle Flournoy, the former president of the Center for New American Security. She was Undersecretary of Defense for policy. But one of the things I would want to ask Michelle Flournoy, because she's so close to defense contractors, her former organization is largely supported by these defense contractors. How is she going to be an effective advocate for the national interest in cutting and reducing spending the Department of Defense when, you know, her whole operation that she built is essentially on the backs and done with the funding of the Defense Contracting Council? So we're all distracted by the Hagel thing, but not asking fundamental questions about the other key possibilities. And that's what the GOP is learning they can get away with Barack Obama, and I think it's a real big mistake, and it's a bad pattern for him to be teaching his rivals how to beat him.
Right, and of course he would then, if he appointed Michelle Flournoy, he'd turn around and say what a historic moment it is to have the first woman as Secretary of Defense without, of
course.
Well,
MSNBC is saying exactly that. I just listened to a show with Karen Finney and Crystal Ball, where they said, "Oh, I really support her because she got children. She's one." What does that have to do? I mean, look, I'm all for women's rights and media. It has nothing to do with being Secretary of Defense. I could support Michelle Flournoy because of her capabilities as a strategist, her thinking about defense structure. I have big concerns about her relationship with the defense contracting crowd and community where they're going. But these other issues become the things that hijack us. And that, I think, is what you see in the progressive media today, that because she's a woman, she's a better candidate for the Secretary of Defense.
And of course, she was a great proponent of the of counterinsurgency, which was the failed strategy that mercifully Joe Biden was able to reverse, the Petraeus strategy, which would have kept us in Afghanistan ad infinitum.
With a much larger force, and you're right on target. She made it kind of a nest for many of the acolytes and followers of General Petraeus.
So let's turn, this is obviously very much a story of the moment, what's happening with Chuck Hagel, or what we think's happening with Chuck Hagel. And I'm astounded that the president would appear to be this malleable, but we'll see what happens. The cabinet has just been announced by Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who is the seventh prime minister in 6 years. He was ousted ignominiously in 2007.
He's our Grover Cleveland.
Well, barely a year. And of course he was ousted. He resigned for ill health, and now he's coming back saying he's going to have bold economic policies that will tackle stagnation and deflation. So, is there any good news there?
Well, Shinzo Abe is someone we've all known. He was very much a real hardliner in national security affairs in Asia. Figuring out what hardline means in any of these countries is sort of a complicated issue now and then, because all of them seem to be going at each other over small islands in the Pacific. China, on the other hand, has declared most of Southeast Asia under its sovereignty. So at the same time, Japan and people like Shinzo Abe flirt with a lot of history deniers in Japan. That fundamentally don't look at themselves as having, launched and engaged in many atrocious activities for World War II. And so this is a way to achieve, political success. And Abe came into office by resurrecting, at the time, the abductee issue with North Koreans. Not to say that abducted people from Japan shouldn't be an important issue, but when you have strategically consequential and fragile negotiations going on over North Korea's nuclear program, Japan sabotaged almost all of those because of its refusal to move forward on a very emotional issue inside Japan. The first time at bat, Shinzo Abe turned out to be very, very immature as a leader and strategically just tone deaf. And I think now what he's done in the failure of the Democratic Party of Japan to hold itself together and to deliver on many of the things it said, he's sidestepping a lot of these national security issues and instead coming in at the economic, that Japan is now running a debt-to-GDP level that is, among all industrial nations, just gargantuan. It's basically more than, three times that of the United States on a percent of GDP basis. And it's very hard to see how Japan, with a declining population and an aging population, ever grows out of this massive debt problem. And so what's happened is the country has been caught in an incremental deflationary contraction for a long time. And he's now trying to come in and say, well, we're going to set a 2% inflation rate and try and punch the Japanese economy out and reverse these trends so that we haven't expanded. I don't know if it will work or not. I think there's a lot of doubt. I certainly hope that you never want to take a leader like Abe or any others and wish them poorly. I hope he does well, but I think Japan is at an inflection point on whether it just sort of, Charles Johnson used to say, unless Japan begins to get smarter about the choices that it's making, it will just slowly slip away and become the Argentina of Asia. Argentina having been a once great, rich, one of the richest and arguably most powerful countries in the hemisphere, in this hemisphere. And he's saying that may be the future of Japan if Japan doesn't get better at this. So I hope Abe succeeds. I don't have much confidence, given what we've seen from him in the past, that he will.
Well, Toyota just announced that they're number one car company again, and I'm always astounded, Stephen. I know you've studied Japan, and you co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Center. So tell me, how is it that they could be such a successful exporter, that their manufacturing sector does so well? So all the money that the manufacturing sector piles up, the financial sector squanders. I mean, what the hell's going on?
Well, you see in their private sector, and you saw when Japan rose and companies like Toyota and others were were built and cultivated and established and became the global powerhouses that they are, that there was extremely smart policy coordination between the government then and the private sector. I think that has given away so much, and Japan has a mix of things. You know, it's a nation that has a lot of conflicts in it, where you've got super powerhouses like Toyota, which do continue to play a massive global role. Remember, Japan is still the third largest economy in the world today. It used to be the second, but China has surpassed it. It is an economic powerhouse, but it is tightly, tightly regulated inside Japan for its domestic economy. And it's still a very hard country to penetrate with American goods and services or European goods and services, all of whom vastly prefer to do business in China today, to tell you the truth, than they try to do in Japan. So, you know, to a certain degree, Japan has an opportunity, which is basically to bite the bullet and take on a lot of its domestic constituencies and try and deregulate these and become a more open place. I think it's something Chalmers Johnson and others with JPRI would have recommended, but it has never been able to manage that politically so that its political institutions, which, you know, you just said seven prime ministers. Why have you had seven prime ministers in 6 years? Because the place produces unbelievable political weakness and tends to preference political weakness over political strength and vision. You haven't had a strong leader in Japan since Koizumi and before him, Prime Minister Nakasone, some time ago. Those leaders are very, very rare in Japan because the system defies those who try to deregulate it because they've got so many vested interests and huge profits tied up in keeping things as they are.
But didn't they, when they had the decade, the lost decade, didn't they, isn't that a warning for us not to take the austerity path and to stimulate? I mean, isn't that what happened? That they...
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, well, it's not only Japan's lost decade that I think is there, where fundamentally my worry about the U.S. economy, we haven't talked about this much, is that you've got a lot of other bubbles that still lie in financial houses and institutions where you have large, you know, the American homeowner has, in my opinion, to be blunt, still been screwed by the deals that were done in the aftermath of this. Their portfolios have really not been marked down to values of their homes in ways that it wasn't their problem, you know, that such a structural corruption undermined the economics of the country. And it's still that debt. We're back at about 100, you know, in the private sector. This is not government sector debt, but the private sector debt in the United States is 160% of GDP. That's where it was before, just at the 2008-2009 financial crisis. And that tells you that not only are we re-leveraging in the country, but we have not really, despite the mythology we hear in the press, we have not really written down much of those loan portfolios. And in the corporate real estate and others, you still have a lot of bubbles. That worries me much more in terms of replicating circumstances inside Japan and ending in, you know, a period of very dormant low growth because there's no spring in the economy. And we're basically, you know, allowing the management of these banks and financial houses and their stockholders to remain whole while turning a blind eye to how soft their asset bases are.
Well, Steve Clements, I thank you for joining us here today. We touched on a range of subjects, and I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Ian. Thanks so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Steve Clements, who is a Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He is also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation, and previously he served as executive director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Stan Misrahi and Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.